If you think you can't go from politics to the divine, Carol Gold and Steve Clark are about to take you above the fray. The only agenda here is to empower you to think for yourself, ask more questions, and trust your own truth. So now, the combination talk radio has been missing. Until now, Carol Gold and Steve Clark taking you above the fray.
Hi, everybody. Welcome. I'm Carol Gold, and I'm here with my co-host, Steve Clark. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Carol.
Area code 914-803-4522 here at Above the Fray if you want to join the conversation. Steve, I want to talk about the Republicans and the Democrats, but probably in a way that most people aren't used to hearing about Republicans and Democrats, and that is that I had a thought this week that there is really a seed of good in both of those parties. So let me explain what I mean. Historically, Republicans stand for rugged individualism. They're all about the individual being able to accomplish almost anything within someone's imagination, living here in the United States where it is possible without a caste system, without restrictions on how far someone can go in terms of success. It's possible for someone to achieve what we've always called the American dream here in the United States, and that has been the core of the Republican message. Similarly, with the Democrats, they've had a message too. Their message is different. The Democratic Party, I think as most people perceive it, is a party that has always been for the good of the whole, the collective, shall we say, and that we are an amazing power because we are all connected in a way that allows us to handle the underprivileged, handle the downtrodden, create social programs that address the very human needs that we have as a society. The problem, as I see it, is that the Republican message of rugged individualism has always been, and now most particularly is limited to, the economic or the financial aspects of someone's life. So when you talk to people about Republicans, the first thing that comes to mind is successful business people or people who think it's all about the individual getting the most they can get, making the most money they can make, becoming as rich as they can, and almost the heck with everybody else and the heck with the downtrodden. The Democrat message has also, I think, been narrowed and thereby perverted. Similarly, in that the Democrat message has become one of collectivism, almost like socialism, where, and I stress the ism because it's become a philosophy, a political philosophy, where the whole is more important than the individual to the point of the expenditure of the individual. And the way to protect the whole and thereby allegedly the individual is to have a giant federal, socialized, central government that takes care of everybody. And that has been the downfall, as I see it, of the Democrat Party. However, in each of those, there is a beautiful principle. It is true that we all are individuals. It is true that we are all individually gifted. And it is also true that, Steve, we've got terrible rattle on the show. I don't know where it's coming from. I see it through the sound system. Steve, I think it's coming from your end. While I'm just continuing to talk on the show, can you try to call back in, Steve, and see if that sound stops? When you hang up, I'll know that it in fact was that sound. Okay. So what I would say is, and it is your sound, Steve, because I just cut off your sound and the rattle or the noise stopped. Okay. Forgive my audience, please, our audience for the moment. Let me jump back in here with where I was. The beauty of the Republicans is that we are all individuals. We are all born with unique and blessed talents, each in our own way, and that an individual can, with determination and with hard work, as in this country anyway, rise to levels that almost surpass one's imagination. It is also true that we are virtually unable to excel on our own. It always takes, not a village, like Hillary Clinton said, and as President Obama said, you didn't make that on your own, not in that sense, but in the sense that we are all connected. We are all tied to one another in a very beautiful way. And if you take the best of the Republican message, which is individualism matters and should be honored and has unlimited potential, and you take the message of the Democrats, which is that we are all connected and we are all in a way responsible for one another. If you meld the two of them, you get the best of both worlds, and what you actually get is something better than we have right now. Because what has happened now is that along with being divided by class and along with being divided by race, we have become divided in our politics to the point where we no longer listen to the other side or believe the other side has anything to offer. And my concern is that if we continue down this road where we believe that the other side has nothing to offer, we will find ourselves lopsided. We will find ourselves out of balance. Because then either one philosophy or the other will prevail. One political agenda or the other will prevail. And I don't believe our success is in either one of those individually. It's in the harmony and the unity and the working together of both of those. This can't be legislated, it can't be mandated, it can't be passed down from a president and enforced upon a nation. It has to come from a change of our thinking, a shift in our paradigm, and a change of our heart. When that happens, when we begin to see the good in both, and when we change our hearts to open up to everyone being able to make a contribution, regardless of their political philosophy, then I think we have a choice and we have a chance. Steve, what do you think about all that?
In principle, I agree with your take on it, but I think we've kind of ended up at a point of no return. Part of the problem, I just think, is as you said, is that it's become political in nature, and the end result is that the politicians have their own agendas now that are radically different than the views of or representing the views of the people. I think what's happened is that both parties have realized that the money is in the masses. So for the Republicans, it's easier to raise money from very large corporations, your IBMs, your Merrill Lynch's, your Goldman Sachs, for example. I'm not saying they're Republican or Democrat. It just becomes easier to get that money and to represent those interests there. And on the Democrat side, it's easier to represent, you know, big trade unions, big police force unions, big government unions, and represent those issues. Because there's certain ways in politics that you can launder money. The first case is if you give money through a political union, that money can, if the dues that get paid by the members, then eventually can be re-put right back into, you know, Democratic Party campaigns. In the same way with the Republicans, they do it through different ways, where one of the ways that they do it is through consulting gigs after they leave office. They can do it through speeches, as Hillary Clinton is showing everybody how to do that right now. And so, getting back to your point, I think the people, the unwashed, the unwashed masses, your straight people that have your straight 9-to-5 jobs or your small independent entrepreneurs are really no longer represented by either class. And so the debates are easier to have, and the lines are easier to draw on for the political masses to say, you know, Republicans are big business, bad, Democrats helping the little guys, they're bad. And so the issues that really, I believe, that could matter to the individuals are no longer addressed, because they don't have a voting mechanism, or I should say, a money mechanism to influence the voting mechanism. And so I think that's where we've ended up with two very polarized and political parties now.
So I will agree with you as to the state and the condition of how things are. And I agree with you, Steve, as to why they are the way they are. Follow the money, right? We see that in all aspects of our lives. What I'm saying is things are no more corrupted now than they were when the Pharisees ruled ancient Israel. They're no more corrupted than then. And there were political factions there too. There were the Sadducees and the Pharisees, and they were not aligned. They were both ruling the people, but they had two very different political agendas. When Jesus came along, and I'm making a religious analogy, or some would say a spiritual analogy, because I think it is particularly apt. When Jesus came along, I'm sure the prevailing thought was, there's nothing we can do. We're just people, right? And they're the political parties that rule, and the Pharisees have the power, and the Sadducees have the money, and we're just people. We're just, you know, we're basically enslaved to the political hierarchy. And then one person came along and said, no, 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 we got to look at this differently. You know, there are all these laws, but there's a simpler way. And being caught up in all the laws is what has done us in, and we need to look at this more simply. What I'm saying is that when I wrote the blog, and what I'm talking about here now, is not a denial of the way things are. I'm simply talking about a shift in the way we see them, because wasn't it just a shift in the way the people saw their life that changed humankind remarkably as a result of him saying, let's just look at things a little differently. The system is very broken. The system is very corrupt. And let's look at it differently. And his vision of seeing it differently, of seeing the inherent potential for good and for love and the power of both, made the difference for thousands of years thereafter. So I'm not denying what you see, but when you say you think we're, what was the expression you used? We're at the end of the road or the point of no return. I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing, because looking at it differently can begin to give us a sense of hope again. And I'm very careful about using that word, because hope and change got us nowhere. I really believe that seeing it differently, Steve, gives us an opportunity to say, you know what, there is good in it. There was a seed of good, as there was 2,000 years ago. It's just that we need to begin to look at it differently, to reevaluate our own priorities, because that's what people did back then. They shifted their priorities, and it changed literally society and then humankind. At least the trajectory that humankind was on. Now, one could argue we've slipped up, but I would argue, no, we're just at a different plateau on a climb, on an endless climb. We reached a plateau, and now if we want to go up further, we need to reevaluate how we get there.
Yeah, I think you're being, you know, quite optimistic. I kind of look at it as, you know, kind of the analogy of, you know, that the, there's a book, and I forget the name of the book, escapes me right now, where essentially the theory is, as societies grow and get more complex, it requires greater and more complex solutions. And there's an element of truth to that, and I think the truth that we have now is that we do have a much more complex society, and we do need much more complex solutions. And so that level of complexity is what's dragging us down. And so, for example, if you look at, in just really basic examples, if you look at laws that were written in the past, they might be, you know, a handful of pages. Now, this is not so long ago. This might be 100 years ago. If you look at even the most basic laws now, there are thousands of pages. It takes months to discern and months to figure out. The perfect example might be, you know, for example, the Dodd-Frank law. It took many, many hours of lawyers looking through the documents, then implementing the policies, and then finding out where the banks would get fined or not get fined for what their actions. The same way, the same example I could give for Obamacare, where Nancy Pelosi made the comment is, we'll read the bill after it's passed. meaning the people who write the laws have now thrown in the towel, that they're writing laws and they're no longer even reading them. It's the height of insanity. But that gets passed as the norm now because they're trying to address an issue that is quite enormous. It is almost too complex, and we're still trying to solve it with these kind of very large, big institutions to solve these problems. And so that's where I think we're running into it. It's not just so much of being an optimist. It's also the nature of the size and scope of the government that we have now that governs us.
Okay, so you make the point that we're more complex. Things are more complex because the bigger they get, the more complex they are. And I wouldn't disagree with you. I spent a portion of time in my life studying complex adaptive systems, and we are one. We are one as a culture. We are one. Actually, our bodies are complex adaptive systems, and societies are complex adaptive systems, and corporations are complex adaptive systems, which is where complexity science comes from. And there is, of course, that argument that the more complex the system, you can fix something in one corner, but it will create a change elsewhere. And so you're constantly in the process of adapting to changes you make. And the larger the system, the more complex those interactions get. While that's true, you know, the Gettysburg Address was 144 words, I think, and, you know, changed the trajectory of this country. I think that we get trapped in thinking that simple must be wrong and complex must be right. I don't think that's necessarily so. And yes, I think we're very big and maybe too big for our britches in the sense that what the founders envisioned in this country, you know, they envisioned it, they anticipated the problems, and now the problems are here, right? We've got a president end running the Constitution. We've got a Congress that's so busy keeping itself in business, it isn't doing the people's business. At the same time, the solutions probably are not complex. The solutions may be some of the time, age, old, you know, solutions that have worked forever. When you break it down, things like, I mean, Gandhi said, be the change you want to see in the world. I don't think that's so frivolous. I think he lived it and proved that it's so. I think that the solutions are what they've always been, and that we get sidetracked and we get fearful that it's just all too big. It's just too big. You know, it was the banks were too big to fail. Well, yeah, no, they weren't. They should have, but they stuck in some creative solution that really wasn't a solution. It was a temporary stopgap, and the banks failing or the economy crashing, it will come eventually because there are certain immutable laws to complex systems, and if you don't follow them, and they're pretty simple, you know, as an aside, I'm writing a book right now. It's about to be published called The 12 Cardinal Principles, and it's actually about some very basic 12 simple universal principles that apply in every aspect of our lives. I don't think it has to be a complex solution. I think simple solutions work. One of them is war. It works in the short run. It doesn't work in the long run. Another simple solution is love. It tends to work a lot longer than war or fear or destruction do. So I just think we have to return to some simple concepts and stop believing that things are so complex we can't solve them.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's a measure of simplicity that'll solve the problem. I'll give a great story that I think addresses this. When I worked at a bank during my career, and one of the banks that I used to have to sell was at the height of the mortgage crisis, and we would have to analyze and sell some of these mortgage products. To be full disclosure, I never sold any of them. I thought they were hugely complex, and I just could never fully understand them. Well, I read a book by Michael Lewis afterward, and there was only a handful of guys that made a lot of money doing the opposite of what the banks were doing. And one of the I forget the gentleman's name had Asperger's, which was a form of social awkwardness. But essentially what he did is he grabbed all the prospectuses of these highly complex transactions, and he spent about 6 months in a room going through each line-by-line item to finally figure it out, to finally figure out what these prospectuses said. So essentially he took 6 months out of his life, shut himself in a room, and that's how long it took him to figure it out. And then he was able to explain to Michael Lewis what these instruments were. So my point is that the height of the financial crisis were built on instruments that nobody fully understood. And the guy that only could understand them had to lock himself in a room for 6 months and had the ability to go through it and concentrate and to understand it, to do it. So essentially, what's the point of this? Is that the system got so complex, a handful of people could only figure out and address the issues and then act appropriately, and that person made millions of dollars. So that's where I think we are now, is just like you said, I think all the solutions that presented us are overly complex, and there is a beauty in simplicity that I think we've lost in all aspects of business, finance, and, you know, the government for that matter.
And in our lives in general, probably. But you just made my point, not in the way you intended. Let's go back to who was able to understand it. Granted, it took him 6 months or 6 weeks, whatever you said. You said he had Asperger's. He clearly had a mind that was perceiving things differently. Now, I know Asperger's is a manifestation, meaning it's a speech issue and it's an ability to control thought into speech, etc. But it also tells me that that person's brain is wired differently. And that's the point I'm making. We are so conditioned. We have been so spoon-fed how we have to think and how it has to be and how disempowered we are and how complex it all is. And what if we don't prop up those banks, because then everything will collapse? Well, maybe it will, but guess what? The way it's been handled hasn't worked. It's brought us to the point where every economist I hear on every show, whether they're gold-oriented or they're futures-oriented or they're selling bonds or whatever their perspective is on the economy, most economists you listen to now say something's coming and it isn't pretty. And it's because the way it's been done doesn't work. And ultimately, what doesn't work, as I see it, Steve, are things that benefit the few at the expense of the many. I think it's anti-nature. You know, in nature, yes, we have predators and yes, we have victims, but we also have a system that miraculously, continuously balances itself out when left alone and works. And it works because every component part makes a contribution, and then the whole interacts in a way that perpetuates each and every member of the whole. No one thrives at the expense, at the total expense, at the annihilation completely, the annihilation of another. We as humans haven't been operating that way. We've been operating actually the antithesis of that model. And a very few benefit at the cost and the expense and sometimes the annihilation of the many. And I think that's what doesn't work, and that's where we've driven ourselves. We've driven ourselves to a point where the system needs a reset. And the reset either comes through our own awakening and our own change of how we talk about and how we see and how we talk about our world, whether it's our economic world or our political world or our social world, or nature itself will self-correct, meaning the economies will collapse or we will have some kind of natural disaster. Whatever it is, I always say, or aliens, will refocus us to come back to a more simplistic way and a more realistic way and a more holistic way of seeing the world and dealing with each other.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think the system will correct. I mean, what we're doing, on an economic level has never been done, and anybody who's ever tried to do the things that we're doing has all ended badly. And I think it becomes a little bit of hubris on our part that we actually think we can manage these things, that we have the ability to control economies, we have the ability to control money, we have the ability to do these things, and not recognizing that's we can. I mean, the best analogy I can give is it's like if you go on a sailboat, nobody tries to control the wind; they try to manage the wind. They put up the sailboat and they adjust the sail accordingly to the direction of the wind, and they try to manage the force that's in it, but never at one point do they say, do they try to generate their own wind and try to move it in its outside of its scope or outside of its nature. And I think it's a very appropriate message of what they're trying to do to the economy right now.
Well, the hubris that you mention is, we have tried to control that which has been within, quote, our control. We have tried to manage reality. We have tried to harness nature. We have tried to take advantage of all the physical world that's around us. And in the process, we've done a lot of damage. But we've also created artificial intelligence, which I think could be the ultimate joke, because at some point, artificial intelligence will begin to manage us. And so we have to be very careful about abuse of power, because there's always one more corner to turn, which isn't always visible at the moment, which is why you have to create with ethics and with decency and with morals, because when you don't, you open yourself up for something that can turn around and bite you back. And I think that's also an edge that we're on, which is the edge of artificial intelligence becoming so smart that it can organize itself and then decides that we're disposable, the same way that we've decided there are species in Africa that are disposable because we like ivory and because we like alligator pocketbooks or whatever it is, whatever species it is that we decide is expendable, because we proceed without ethics and without morals and without a sense of what's in the greatest good for all concerned. So I agree with you, Steve, that we're at a tipping point. I think your language was point of no return. I don't necessarily think it's a bad thing. I just think we have to wake up and be very cautious and conscious about how we see the world from here on out and what we allow ourselves to participate in. I wish I had more time, just about 2.5 minutes. The example I would give, I'm recently watching West Wing DVDs. I never saw the series. And last night there was an episode about Jimmy Smits, who plays President Bartlett's successor, or at least I think he's going to be the successor. And as he's trying to get the Democratic nomination and he's running against the current vice president who's seeking the presidential nomination, Jimmy Smits is asked to compromise his values to get where he wants to go. And he won't do it. He won't do it because he doesn't think it's worth getting where he wants to go if he has to give up what it is the essence of who he is. And I think that's where we are. We better wake up and realize that if we keep on the trajectory we're on and seeing things the way we have, which is as victims and as powerless within ourselves, we will find ourselves having relinquished more than we could afford to relinquish. And that would be the only thing I think that can actually do us in. Thanks for listening to tonight's show. I want to encourage everyone, Steve, to continue to follow us on Blog Talk Radio so you know when the shows are on, and to like us on Facebook and check out our Above the Fray podcast blog that we write several times a week. Thanks for joining us here at Blog Talk Radio, Above the Fray podcast. I'm Carol Gold.
I'm C. Clark.
And have a great week, everybody. We'll be back again Monday at 6 p.m. Central. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Above the Fray with Carol Gold and Steve Clark, from politics to the divine. Thanks for being a part of a new way to see the world. Visit our website at AboveTheFrayPodcast.com and like us on our Facebook fan page, Facebook.com/AboveTheFrayPodcast. This has been Carol Gold and Steve Clark, taking you always above the fray.